Welcome to episode 27 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. All of Your Business is a proud recipient of a 2020 X-Ray FM Podcast Award. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM. You can also find them at xray.fm. On this episode, we're speaking with Amy Germain of Accelerate, a Portland nonprofit for women entrepreneurs. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
I wanted to talk to you. I mean, there's so many things to talk to you about.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
I wanted to talk to you about Georgia, because you're from Georgia, right?
I am from Georgia. I'm from Atlanta.
I mean, tell me about that, but also it must be interesting to see what's going on in Georgia the past 6 months, year.
Yeah, with the voting, so, I mean, it's almost like it's not new news, right? This is voter suppression's the calling card of a state like Georgia. But now, I grew up there in the 70s. I grew up in a white town, which was most of the bedroom community of Atlanta, Georgia, like outside of, you know, these kind of suburbs, bedroom communities of the downtown area. And, you know, I just... We weren't raised in a household that engaged in politics. We didn't feel like we were part of the white community, but my family obviously is all white and privileged folks. But I have a weird childhood. I was pretty much estranged from my family from a very early age and struck out on my own. My mom was off doing whatever my mom did, and my father left when I was two, so I don't know him. And, you know, I just kind of was a child of the community, if you will. And so it's been real interesting. I think I left Atlanta in 94 when the Olympics happened. So I haven't really been back. But what's happening is not anything that's fresh. It's the same old shit, you know. But I think what's different is when you see people like Stacey Abrams. Mm-hmm. And you see black women coming back up into their selves and really controlling and taking charge of the environment. So for me, she is what's fresh and new.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
And she doesn't give a fuck.
No.
I mean, excuse my language. She just is like,
nope.
I'm going to come at you, you know, with facts and with passion, and you're going to listen. And that's it.
But I mean, that's the role of the women in that community. And Georgia's made up of a massive black community. And the fact that they are constantly, their votes either suppressed because of the prison system, right? Felons can't vote, or people in prison can't vote, or they're just suppressed because of the line drawing of the areas, or whatever it is. You know,
or
I think
the
this
new
latest
law.
One is like, you can't like help somebody in line. And
you can't
gotta,
give them water, a water bottle. So it could be...
It's insane, Michael, how ridiculous that sounds. I mean, even people are hearing themselves say that out loud and thinking, wow, we've really reached the depths of our inhumanity.
Well, the question is, or the statement is, like, if you can't win, you cheat.
Well, I mean, this is what happens, right, when, I mean, not to get too political, but you have a minority power that wants to maintain majority power. So how do you do it if you are indeed the minority? Well, you gotta cheat to get there. You know, and in Atlanta, it's a powder keg, right? There's other things going on in that city, but that city is rich in entrepreneurship. It's got a huge LGBTQ community. It's just so diverse and it is pumping. It's a heart, it's a beating heart of this country for a reason, because it's diverse and rich. And that is what Georgia is. And it takes all the parts and pieces of Georgia to make it. I just don't understand why the government wants to suppress that. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And this is the same thing that we see when we're talking about inclusive economies and diversification. I mean, that's biomimicry, right? The world is diverse because that's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how we keep it from crumbling.
Well, and it's the systems. That's the biggest thing, is like, you know, you
that's
can
right.
have lip service. You can be like, oh, we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. But it's like, inherently, whether it's the institutionalization of, you know, jails, prisons, whether it's the systems of the economy, not having access to loans or capital. Same thing with voting. Right. So it's sort of like, unless you shake up, ruin, flip it on its head, defund and plan, you know, these systems, then nothing really changes. That's because right. It's just a moment of like, oh, we care. But then, you know, the proof's in the pudding. Okay, if you care enough to break down the system, or do you just care for a moment as like a media blip, and then that's it?
I mean, the reality is, right, the change that needs to happen is hard. It's going to be painful. Yeah. It's not going to be easy. And tearing it down has to happen. You can't just kind of scratch over something and say, well, we won't do that, we'll do this. Or, gosh, I'll just, you know, maybe we should reconsider this instead of this. Even in the case of Atlanta, like, in reaction, some of the private sector pulled out. You know, the MLB, maybe they stopped their baseball game or whatever. But this isn't even the work. Maybe it's the start, but it's a scratching of the surface.
Sure.
It really needs to be tore down, because what's happening in Georgia is what's been happening. It's not new. Mm-hmm. It just, maybe it's painted different.
I think even today I read about a voter suppression law or order in Florida. So, I mean, this is just a common thing now, that if it's not working out to your advantage, or you don't think it's going to be gerrymandered to your advantage, create voter suppression laws to add to already voter suppression laws.
Well, and what is this is a democracy. So when you take away, I think one of the essential voter suppression things that we see in the South a lot is they just remove polling stations. Like, they just remove it. And you have to go drive 3 hours down the road to go vote. Like, yeah. How is that part, how does anybody subscribe to those kinds of legislative policies in a democracy? That's what you see in Cambodia. And
yeah,
I know because
exactly
I've lived in
right.
Cambodia. So, I mean, that is the reality, and the fact that we can't see past what we're seeing to see that reality is
real
hard.
That's exactly right. And I think that's sort of what's, among other things, has befuddled, or use a word like that,
me, love that.
Is that these are not partisan issues, but they're becoming that way. Like, the idea everybody should vote, that's not a partisan issue. Kids should not have lead in their water, not a partisan issue. You don't want your kid to be shot at school, not a partisan issue. The environment needs to be clean enough to breathe. Like, we're basically, oh, and here's another one, infrastructure. When you're on a bridge, I'm sure you don't want the bridge to collapse.
No, there's,
so
that's right.
The way we do these things surely can be different, but
right.
saying no or voting no is not an option, or saying that I don't want that, you know, because of such and such. There's things that need to be done for humanity. There's things that need to be done. Like, you know, a school shooter doesn't know if your child is a Republican or Democrat.
That's right.
It's so that's what sort of shocks me. I'll use it again, befuddles me, is that where do we as a society go, you know, with people who don't believe in facts, who tread in hate, who don't find common ground because they always say no. And then there's the toxic positivity. Well, there's toxic masculinity, but there's toxic positivity right now, which is we can ignore, you know, 400 years of oppression and put in textbooks that it's just a cute story about slavery, or we can, you know, after this election, deny that there were 70 million plus people who supported or were complicit with racism
That's
or
right.
neo-Nazism, and then just be like, okay, we can work with you now.
We'll
so,
just hug and get along.
So, sure, we can meet them, and sure, this is one America, but why are they not telling us? Like, I'm not in that category. Like, if I was someone who was put in that category, I would say, listen, here's why I did this, or
right.
here's what I was afraid of. But you're right, what you said about this being painful, is this whole entire thing is going to be painful. And so
yeah.
that is a big problem with America, whether it's, you know, macro or micro, of we sort of do things to kick the can down the road. We do things that are pretty. We do things that are not going to hurt those involved. But then to what avail? We have a shit show later.
There's no long-term vision in that kind of thinking. I mean, that's the reality. We're a young country. We embody short-term solutions. Self-interest is important. It's that's the American dream, right? If you recall some of those kind of Lockean principles and the things that the country's built on. It is built on a more short-term vision. And that's been leveraged, right? A divisiveness is important to the way that this country runs. And when you make issues political and partisan, you can create wedges where you want. And so I think that that's a really important thing to remember. And we have a lot of collective trauma that we haven't dealt with. And through my own journey and my journey, my professional journey, I mean, I've really learned, like, if we don't deal with it, we're going to continue to be mired in it. Mm. And it's going to continue to be problematic. So, I mean, I think overall, we have got to figure out a way of not listening to what maybe the politicians or the, you know, the dominant narrative is. And at the community level, figure out how we're going to create real, valuable, long-term, sustainable solutions for our communities. And that starts in us. It's us. I mean, it really is. I have a very hopeful, optimistic view of the world because of that. Because I really do believe that once we figure out how we can heal ourselves and come together, I think it's going to be real easy for us to start making the change.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating thing because I'm like you. I'm a realist, but I'm also cautiously optimistic.
Absolutely.
So I'm both a realist and a dreamer. But, you know, you learn that people are actually kind. So someone who we may not agree with politically may give food to their neighbor when they're in need, may be somewhat loving. We also learn that if you tell someone about something like Obamacare, but you call it the Affordable Care Act, they suddenly are interested in it.
Right.
Or, you know, you talk about the infrastructure bill in a way that is about capitalism or about big business. Okay. You know, like there's creative marketing for problem solving that if it fits in their sort of viewpoint or if it's labeled a certain way. But then when you start playing that game where you're like, this is socialism, this is communism, that they hear that and then they immediately, there's this fear. They don't even know what it is. I mean, what conceptually is it? You know, so those sort of fearful tactics of if you vote for Biden, it's going to be a socialistic country or a communistic country. Your whole life is already somewhat socialistic. You don't deliver your own mail. You don't put out your own fires. You send your kids to public school.
That's right. You know, in the end, for me, though, that just circling around those words and that fear mongering is wasteful. Like, I've, you know, through my, you know, my own leadership and in my professional life, I've just decided that at this point it's about doing and not talking, because I think you can have any number of conversations right now and somebody's perspective is going to get in there. The words twisting thing is like a mechanism that we've all become very good at over the last 4 years, you know, it's just talking about the isms and debating each other about words we can't even agree on. And at this point, do the words really have any more meaning? Like, what's the point in arguing anymore? Like, we all clearly want same things. We want similar things. I really do believe that. Like, I really believe that both sides of the aisle, if we're talking about politics, want the same things for the most part.
But they have to be willing to actually put a couple things on the table that are agreed upon.
Absolutely.
You can't bargain, collaborate, whatever you want to say, with someone who is no to everything. Or,
absolutely.
You know, like, there's got to be, okay, well, what do you want? Okay, you want to try to repeal Obamacare 75 times or whatever the number is? Okay, well, where's your healthcare plan that's better than that? Or why don't you take Obamacare and make it better, and then we'll use your suggestions to make it better.
Absolutely.
So there's not a lot of that. There's a lot of, like, no solutions or no's or because Obama did that. And that's a big problem because the people who are waiting on healthcare are still waiting.
That's right.
The people who are dealing with racism, still thing. People who are dealing with school violence, the environment getting shitty. Like, all the people who need those things, they're waiting for the people in charge to figure out how to actually come together and to actually make these changes.
That's right.
And that's very disheartening. And I'm thinking of AOC,
yeah.
You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and how, like, when she went to Congress, she talked about how she immediately, other than the controversies of her dancing in the hallway, which was ridiculous.
Yeah, of course.
She immediately had a call to raise money for Congress. Like immediately, she became a fundraising machine for them, and they told her what to raise money for. She couldn't even go there right away and like work on the things that she cared about.
Right.
So the point is that money is so deeply tied to politics, but a little boy with cancer has no concept. There's such a disconnect between, not that she doesn't care because she does, but there's a disconnect with, these are leaders who have been voted in and are put there to make these solutions, but yet they get there and they have Mitch McConnell to deal with, they have fundraising to deal with.
That's right.
They have lobbyists from the other side. So at the end of the day, are you talking about that kid with cancer, or are you talking about what, you know, a pharmaceutical company wants?
Well, I think you have to address the incentivization structure first and foremost in this country, because in the end, I really don't even think they see the details, the politicians. Like, they don't see the five-year-old kid. It really is black and white to them insofar as how they're getting paid, who's lobbying them, and what interests they have to represent. And so I think, I mean, for me, one of the first things I would love to see is reformation of lobbying and influence rules. I mean, and I think that is where some of the progressives are focused on, for a good reason. Once you change the incentivization structure, you know, you change behavior. And so I think in a system that rewards certain behavior, here we are. And for me, politically, right. There really isn't much in between until that changes. We've got to, you know, I think the second part of that is why I wouldn't wait for what they want. Like, we're engaged here at this level, building community here at this level, and building relationships with our local reps and our state reps, because that's who we feel like we belong close to and who owe us their time and their energy, and we can hold them accountable.
And it seems like that's also lately one of the most beneficial things, with mutual aid organizations.
Absolutely.
Doing really well and asking your neighbor how they're doing. I mean, those are tangible things. Like, sure, government is tangible, but someone can't wait for a bill to pass if they need food on their table. Like, there's no time for that. So I think that they're all really important. But, you know, I'm, I guess, what you would call a Warren Democrat. So I believe in capitalism, but I believe that it works or should work for social good.
Yeah.
And so there isn't a problem. I mean, you look at the way America runs or the way that it is, like, it actually could work if we did those things. You know, we had all those reforms, and we didn't allow for corporations to not pay taxes. Like, if we were to actually do the things that seem to premise or align with the values that we say that we have, then we would actually have a capitalist society that would care about socialistic things.
Well, you know, Michael, what I'm going to say is you need to put more women in power.
Oh, I 100% agree.
I mean, and honestly, I think that this is where an inclusive economist comes in to say, listen, if we don't diversify, but also, who is the dominant culture only values certain things, or dominant capitalism only values certain things? How do we, again, change that incentivization structure? Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, I work with women and 99.9% come with a social purpose involved in their business. They're just minded like that. Put black women in charge, because they're solutions driven, and they think in the long term, and they've got the skills, the survival skills that it takes to create things that are pliable and agile. And so that is really, I love that that's a good segue into the, like, why we need to have women of color, women in general, at the head of the table.
Yeah, and I 100% agree with you. So tell me, I know I want to talk about Accelerate, but, you know, before that, you mentioned you're a white woman who's privileged from a white family. How does a white woman who's privileged from a white family come to dedicating their life to women's issues, particularly often BIPOC women?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure that you get pushback on that as well. Or you have, because there's this sort of, oh, she is, you know, a white savior type, or she doesn't understand what we're doing, or there's often what white people do, not you, is white people try to prescribe what people need instead of giving them a voice and having them represent. There are a lot of white people that go, oh, this is what you need. Here you go. So I guess tell me, I mean, I don't know if that's a question, but the
it's
first
an awesome
question
yeah.
The first question, you know, is how does a white privileged woman get involved and dedicate, you know, your life to this cause?
Yeah. It's been an interesting journey. You know, I grew up in a really messed up family environment, and we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, so, and I was fairly well, I was the picture of a latchkey kid. I was a Gen Xer, left at home with the key on my neck. Mom was never around, divorced parents. And, you know, I took care of my sister. I just was surviving. I was just trying to keep things together for myself. I don't have a lot of good memories. You know, I just really was like, I need to go to college and take care of myself. I need to learn. And I really struggled. I struggled in my childhood not knowing my parents very well and feeling like I was left to bear the burden of my sister. Which I had to take care of. She was younger than I was, and she had, you know, some mental health issues. And, you know, my family was really good at just ignoring all the stuff, ignoring racial issues and socioeconomic issues. And I was very acutely aware of my, you know, my privilege from a very early age, even as a poor child growing up in Atlanta, Georgia. I was surrounded by other ethnicities and other kids that were a lot like me. And they weren't white. So I also, you know, have a disconnect from my family in that my father is a brown person. I present as white. My sister actually presents a browner. She passes the so-called brown paper bag test. And I don't. I look like my mom, who's white. And so it's been a real hard journey for me. Like, who am I? Even though maybe I don't feel that way inside, I look that way, and it doesn't negate the fact that I walk through this life with pure and utter privilege. And I have. I have two master's degrees. I've gone through a lot of education. I've had no problems or struggles getting into that. And I thought, well, I want to do something meaningful with my life. And I went to law school because that's what I was told I had to do, right, to get ahead. That's what society tells white women like me. Like, you're either going to have kids or you're going to be a lawyer or a doctor and make money. And especially my white middle class family. And I did. I went to law school and I was miserable. The first 6 months I dropped out, I was like, this is misery. I went into the restaurant business. I just felt like I didn't belong anywhere. And the restaurant business is notorious for what they say is, you know, is a host of other degenerates. Although I just say we're a bunch of damaged people that haven't faced our stuff yet.
I don't know if you know, I worked in restaurants for about 10 years.
You did?
So I get it, yeah.
So you get it. Like, that's just where I felt more welcome. Like, I just had a lot of efficacy issues. I didn't believe in myself. You know, I just thought, why am I going into to law school, even though the pathway was paved for me? Now, don't think I don't have a lot of student debt because of it, but I just figured I needed to do something for myself and be myself. And that's really been my pathway, has been really struggling against the system and who I'm supposed to be because I look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I've really struggled with that because it doesn't feel like who I am inside. And so I went on to, you know, I became a chef, gosh, in my 20s. At the age of 35, I was like, I do not know who I am. This does not feel like me. I don't know. It's a damaged universe, the restaurant business. It's a very toxic male environment. And I just thought, I'm built for a higher purpose. And I dropped out and I went to move to Europe and was like, I'm going to go work for the United Nations. And this really, I love how you segued that like white saviorism piece into that, because I thought, well, I'm going to go save the world, or I need to have a social purpose, or, you know, how do I take this energy that I have and this passion, this knowledge of this struggle that I have as a young person, but the privilege that I have to leverage. Like, I just was, again, very acutely aware that I had something unique. I had the knowledge of a harder life, but walked through the world freely honestly. And so I went on to study and go work for the United Nations World Food Program and got invested in food insecurity work because I had already worked in the restaurant business. And so through that, I've basically, since I was 35, turning 45 next week, 10-year journey of exploring what it's like to live in other countries and be invested in this idea that economic development has to be inclusive and that women and people of color have this kind of position in society, but they're the root and core and how we can raise that up. And I've, through that journey, had to be faced with things like development theory and understanding like my role as a white person and avoiding white saviorism. And I stopped working for the UN for that very reason. I was like, who am I to show up in Cambodia or Panama or Senegal, all these places that I've worked?
Angelina Jolie.
I mean, it's hard. But you learn, right? You learn that there's other approaches. There's participatory approaches. There's unique approaches. But even the UN up until, you know, I would say the last 10 years still hasn't figured out how not to be a colonialism, like an imperialist force in the world today. And so here I am, like, wedging these little battles inside myself and figuring out how I fit. And for me, it just made sense as a woman. Mm-hmm. It just made sense as a woman that was the place where I just very well understood because I'd lived the experience, I guess.
It sounds like you didn't really know your parents too well either. And, you know, in that regard, not only growing up fast and taking care of your sister, you didn't really know about their background probably that much. So, you know, you said your dad was brown, but you probably never saw him or knew about him. So, you know, it sounds like you sort of grew older but had no idea essentially either genetically or culturally, you know, who you were necessarily.
No, a lot of question marks. I mean, I had no identity. I had no role models. You know, I've learned why that's happened since, because I've invested a lot of therapy to work through that stuff. But yeah, I was abandoned as a child, and I didn't feel rooted or connected. We moved constantly. We moved to Ireland when I was 9. I was a foreigner in a total foreign land, and I recall it being very traumatic. It was during the first Gulf War. There was a lot of anti-American sentiment in Europe, a lot. It was in 1989 when we moved. You know, I had this really weird accent. I was just, and then, you know, we were dragged there, and then my mother kind of took off and did her thing. And so there was just a constant need to survive. Within that, survival became the primary goal, not the things that you do when you're a kid, Michael, you know, like not getting to know yourself or having a best friend or, you know, having family vacations, things like that. So as a result, I've been fighting a long time, and it's exhausting. Trying to fight and find myself within that, but also in the pure, authentic way, in a loving and equitable way, trying to figure out who I am and check myself on all the other stuff has led me to where I'm at now.
And I know you wear a lot of different hats, you know. I don't know if you still brew, but there's that. There's,
used to brew.
Yeah, there's that. There's, you know, business consulting. I would say you're somewhat of an activist, even if you don't want to admit that you are. and then there's this sort of, you know, social entrepreneurial incubator type that's beyond just business consulting, you know, in my mind. There's a greater thing than business consulting there. So I guess, how do you manage all those different hats, and then how did Accelerate come about?
Well, I mean, you know, when I was in the restaurant business, I didn't realize that I was just naturally gifted. I didn't go to culinary school. I popped into it by fluke. You know, it was something I just did to pay for college. And I happened to be real good at it. It turns out that, you know, I think my father's family comes from a long generation, lines and lines of restaurateurs on the Lebanese and Syrian side, which is what my ethnic heritage is over there. And I think, I do think there's something in that the DNA kind of pushes you towards something that, unbeknownst to you, you're good at. But what I was really good at inside the restaurant business was I was a chef who could cook and I could run the business, which is really unique. You get a lot of chefs that can cook and they don't know how to run the business. And restaurant business is hard to run. It runs on a fine margin. And so really, I figured that was a niche. And so I did. I spent a lot of time working myself into a space where I could sell myself as not only a good chef, but a good entrepreneur. And but I really struggled with getting my own space. You know, I could never, there were line cooks that I was working with and stuff getting their own restaurants, and I couldn't, I just couldn't make it happen. And so I went behind the scenes and started consulting existing restaurants on how to make their costs work and how to make their numbers go. And I really spent a lot of time in my 30s parlaying that and figuring out, okay, well, I can do this. Like, I'm a self-starter. Somebody told me once, fake it till you make it. And I've really held on to that very firmly in my life. And I practice it. Like, get into it. I try and make it go. And so really consulting was the root of that. And then I went into small business consulting. And then I figured out, wow, I can parlay this into a bigger thing. And then I started really understanding through my work at the UN and global work and really branching out internationally, the role that capitalism and informal economies, I did a lot of economic studies on refugee camps and places that are full, like the restaurant business, like Oregon, full of food carts, and how the informal economy interacts with the formal economy, which was my academic, really the academia coming into my life. And that really informed the direction towards Accelerate. I spent a lot of time in Cambodia in 2017-18, working through Laos and Yangon and Thailand, these Southeast Asian countries that are still have a lot of poverty and social inequities. And just listening and observing. And so many women are at the core of all of our communities. It occurred to me that I needed to come back home and do some of that work. I just did. I started consulting a small organization called Woman Led. And some of those women in Portland were involved in Accelerate. And I think I just started networking. And Accelerate contacted me in September of 2019. Because they built a loan program. It'd never been, you know, a character-based lending product that we hadn't seen in Oregon. And I was called in to do some consulting and build the loan origination program for it. So it's funny. It's like but there's one red thread throughout my career. And it really is about, like, in the beginning, it was about food justice and sustainable food movement and being invested in bringing food to our communities. All the way to what I'm doing now, which is working with women and building their capacity to grow. And it's just not two different things. Mm. It really is the same thing. And I really am glad that I think I was on a balcony in my apartment in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, when I thought, why am I here when I know my country is really struggling with some of the same stuff? Granted, that's informed my approach. But I thought I need to come back here and work on some of these things. And for me, it starts with women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that I wanted to ask you about this because I know a little bit, but, you know, I get questions. So, you know, tell people what BIPOC is. Tell people, believe it or not, people don't know. Tell people what women and then with the X, you know, people don't know, like identifying as a woman. Talk a little bit about that.
The categories that exist when we talk about inclusivity.
Correct, yeah.
These words, this language becomes quickly outdated. So I'll tell you what's happening today. But and our language is outdated. You know, we're learning right now that our language is rooted, obviously, and obvious to me, but slavery and capitalism and these kinds of oppressive systems. So we have to constantly question the words. But woman, Accelerate uses woman with an X. And we don't do that all the time. We don't put an X whenever we see the word men because we hate men. Like, that's not how that works. We do it only when we're speaking about the community we serve in a broader sense of the term, because we actually do serve gender fluid individuals and non-binary folk. So there are individuals, and there's a very large spectrum of gender.
Yeah.
And that's becoming more and more clear as we evolve our language, that maybe using the word woman doesn't apply to some people. But there are some people that maybe feel like a woman or look like a woman or resonate with the some of the barriers that women face. So we indicate that we serve them with an X. If we know that they're a woman, we call them woman. They're a woman. So there's that. And trans women are women. We don't use an X when we talk about trans women. Trans women are women.
You mean you're not a TERF?
No.
Maybe tell listeners what that acronym...
What is that? What's the full... I can't recall what the F...
we're both sitting here.
We're supposed to know this.
I mean, the biggest thing to know is that it's just... It's when women only believe that women who are born with the biological sex female are women. They don't recognize trans women as women.
That's, I mean, and for us, we're not here, like, the world, life is too short to debate whether somebody wants to feel a certain way or look a certain way, like they do. And
it
so
seems exhausting to be so hateful. I don't understand. Yeah.
When that comes up, I just look at people and I think, you have a very boring life. Like, and I think this whole environment that we're looking at with the internet and really the access of information, we just have either too much time on our hands or we've just lost. I don't have that kind of time on my hands, nonetheless. Trans women are women, by the way. POC has always been a term we've used, people of color, communities of color. BIPOC is oftentimes used, BIPOC, which is Black, Indigenous, people of color. Although now there's the Latinx community are a little upset that that doesn't have an L in it to include them. So we try and stay away from that. I mean, we serve communities of color. We serve women of color more than anything. And I think the most important thing about all these acronyms, you might say, why is, like, what is this? Well, it's real hard as, like, for an organization like ours to constantly repeat, like, Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Hispanic, Chicana. I mean, you could go on and on with the identifiers. And I think at this point, we're just saying, you know, these communities that cannot participate, Michael, in the formal economy like everybody else, because of the way that the system is built, have clearly been discluded, clearly been oppressed, and these are the folks that we target for that reason. Now, within that, there's also LGBTQ, veteran, immigrants, refugees, and a lot of people say, well, by the time you get through the list, you've got everybody in there, right?
Yeah, that reminds me of talking to, you know, a person in their 80s about, like, either words like queer or LGBT, and then they're like, well, what's LGBTQ plus or IA or and that's the interesting thing, is there are intersectionalities not just within one of those things we're talking about, but even within, you know, being half Black, half white, and being non-binary or being, you know, that sort of thing.
And the G's don't like the T's sometimes, and the L's don't like the, I mean, there's all kinds of, like,
yeah, and I'm a gray area thinker, right? So we need to not put the people who are not doing it perfectly into the category of hate. So if someone's kind of like, oh, they're not sure about pronouns, but they're getting there, they're trying, they stop and they acknowledge, okay, that's different from someone who doesn't recognize a person's existence or the ability to be who they are. So I think we all sort of, as a society, need to assume best intentions. But if we know right away that there's not best intentions, of course, don't assume them. But we need to be about education.
And
when I say about education, that doesn't mean that the person, because this is a big problem now, it doesn't mean that, you know, a Black person spends their whole entire life explaining to white people what Black culture is or why That's racism right. exists. That's not their responsibility.
That's right.
And same thing with a queer or trans person, is it's not their responsibility. And I think, you know, my law firm and what Accelerate does is similar in the sense that there is time for that education and there's time to talk about identity. But these are people who don't want to spend 70% of their meeting that day explaining who they are. They want to be met where they're at for who they're at, who,
That's
for
right.
who they are. And I have trans clients and friends who tell me that if they were to go to another law firm, another CPA, whoever it is, CPA, financial advisor, even if those people are not full of hate, they spend most of the meeting talking about their gender identity and not talking about opening a business or talking about how to save for their future.
That's right.
Or so that is something that we need to learn as a society, is you can learn about different people on your own time. Having someone who's different, you can ask them what the difference is and how you can respect it, but it's not a time for you to ask someone question, you know, 20 questions about their transition if they're coming in to see you for business law services. Right.
Well, again, for me, it's like, well, you're getting into the details of which normally we wouldn't exchange that information. I mean, does it really matter? All that matters, I think, in general, is that those that don't have need help getting up. And so how do we resource under-resourced communities, you know? How do we give access? Those of us with privilege can lever that in the favor of someone else. And what does that do for us? It doesn't do anything. It doesn't take away. It's not like a pie.
Sure.
You know?
It's like, funny you say that, because we've had so many, as society, so many of these zero-sum arguments.
That's right.
You know, and that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I'm going to use all these cheesy things, but, you know, like the rising tide lifts all boats,
that's
that
right.
expression and stuff like that. Like, if you're a decent person, you want your neighbors to succeed. You also, if you have a business, you want another business owner to succeed, because they're probably going to come and utilize your business as well.
That's right.
And so I don't get that either, where there's just this, like, yes, there are limited resources, but there's also people who can create new businesses. There's also people who are doing things that you're not. There's people who are different that need to express themselves. But one of the things I was thinking about too is Accelerate kind of reminds me of a very modern version of the give a man a fish, you know, or teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime.
Lead it's kind of
like, yeah, it's kind of like that, but it's like, give a woman or identifying woman, you know, skills. And there's this furtherance of, they may not have to work a shitty ass job for the rest of their life, or three, they can create their own business. They can have,
absolutely,
they can utilize who they are, and they can implement that and their passions, and they can do something to provide a living, but also something that's fulfilling. And so there's something really beautiful about that. And I think we share, I mean, we do different things, but we share a similar
Absolutely.
Goal of that, of helping people push forward, you know, to reach that point of, yes, you can do it. And a lot of that is, you know, there's some business consulting, there's some teaching, there's cheerleading, there's, you know,
it takes all that stuff. I mean, let's let everybody in on a little secret here. Like, when we all do well, when all of us do well, we all are going to do well. Like, there's just not that, like, concentrated wealth trickles down, or, like, you know, something's going to come and take care of us. Like, that's just not how that works. I mean, especially when the women in our communities do well. Like, keeping a woman in the household penting up all that labor and unpaid labor, and that's not helping anybody. So yes, and secondly, you know, what you and I are doing are not just providing education and trying to, you know, bring knowledge, and which is power, to the people, but it's also to role model and to set examples and to build efficacy. Like, we're really focused on, we don't empower women. We don't ever say that. Like, women are in their power. Mm. We really believe that. It's just that you don't necessarily always know. You don't know what kind of innate power you have. And I know that from a lived experience. I never felt like I was good enough. I never felt like I was ever going to be anybody. I still have to battle those demons. And I think if you can get to a point where we spend a lot of time just telling women that they can, that they have the innate capacity to do things. And once we give them the materials that they need, they can do it on their own. Like, we're not here, like, trying to, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that that's a really different approach when you start, I think conservatives often get mixed up, like, oh, well, this is affirmative action, or, you know, why are you helping those people? They can't help themselves. That's just absolutely not the point. And I think when you're talking about trauma, and you're talking about collective trauma, and you're talking about what women and people of color have had to endure in this country, and you're not willing to stop and set the time aside to work with that, then we're all going to be really damaged. And this thing's never going to get fixed. Because in the end, I really believe that we have to deal with our stuff, and we have to help other people deal with their stuff. And that starts with women telling them that they're capable. Yes, you are capable. Yes, you can. Here's the tools. Here's your toolbox. Here's other women that have done it. So we do a lot of convening of women just in general, all kinds, so that role modeling is present and social persuasion is present and all the things that humans, like, these are academic, behavioral, social cognitive theory is what we use. Peer mentorship. Helping each other out. I think there's a narrative that women are competitive and catty with each other. It's just not true.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not true.
And also, people seeing other people that are like them helps fulfill. You know, there's a black child seeing Stacey Abrams.
That's right.
And like if all a black child sees is either white women or men. So there's this sort of mentoring, mirroring thing, but there's also this representation of, you know, as a child, or if not a child, you know, at 35.
Right.
I see a woman who looks just like me, and she started her own business. I probably can. So tell me, programmatically, I mean, where do you begin? There's a lot of stuff you're doing, I know. But kind of give us a survey of what you're working on.
Yeah, I mean, Accelerate, when it started, it was founded to be a loan program. It really, I mean, to fill that gap, that very significant gap. You can't get capital. You really can't. As a woman, I think the SBA lending rates are like 14% in 2019. They're horrific. You add color to that, it changes the game totally. 2.2% in 2019 of venture capital went to women. That's a horrible statistic. We cite those statistics all the time, and we wanted to come up with a character-based lending product, which is a solution to the conventional lending picture now. Now, through that journey, Accelerate's learned that education has to be there, too. People aren't capital ready for a good reason. There's education components missing, particularly for women. I think that people forget that 24 years ago, I believe, is the date women in Oregon could not have a checking account without a male cosign. Only 24 years ago was that a policy in this state. And so it's really important to understand that the mechanisms for even capital and access are where it's a non-starter for women. It's like land, which women don't have traditionally not inherited. Imagine if you're a woman of color. And then collateral and credit scores, these things that you don't have a good credit score historically if you couldn't even have a checking account. So, I mean, it's just a non-starter. We're trying to obviously change the picture there and educate lenders and policymakers. And I think that's definitely where a lot of activism and advocacy comes in for Accelerate. But what we learned through that work is that women need community. And so we've really focused on convening. You know, peer mentorship is one of our most popular programs. And those are just small curated groups of women going through the same stuff. And there's a facilitator there. And our approach is to hear people and to promote education, yes. But also, it's like therapy. So we're addressing some of the collective trauma. And what's happening here, especially in Oregon, which, as you know, is a dominant white state, is we're able to convene mixed race groups. And women, white women, are able to listen and hear and be in a room with women of color. And that's been really powerful. Mm-hmm. Because that we know that part of the movement to break down, tear down the racist systems is getting white women on board and getting them to practice their own learning and getting, I mean, that really starts with them just hearing. Mm-hmm. Like, even in a group where a woman's like, hey, you know, we talk a lot about storytelling in business. I know you do some workshops on this. Like, hey, y'all, you got to resonate with the customer by telling your story. Show who you are, you know, talk about yourself. And then even in that conversation, people forget that a Black woman's not going to put her face on her website. That's trauma. That's hard. That's a frightening, fear-based place to have to live. And so, A, we get to share that story with white women so they can understand why a Black woman would feel fearful in that space and come up with creative solutions together to do the work, right? To be capitalists, but with hearts and social purpose.
That's wonderful. And it's so not funny or ironic. I don't know what the word would be, but the simplest theory is the contact theory of if you actually meet people who are different, the walls come down.
Proximity.
So that's all it takes is, but you know, people keep themselves in a bubble and they choose what to believe or they tell another story. So I love that there's a group where those experiences can actually be tied to someone who you met.
That's right.
And you know, okay, this is a hardworking woman just like me. And here's a story.
That's
and
right.
These are real things. I mean, I hear people saying, you know, that racism isn't real or that microaggressions aren't real or like these are real things. Like people go in Walgreens and they're followed because people think they're going to shoplift. You know, people get stopped. I mean, we see it every day. There's this sort of, I don't know if it's a white woman thing, and I'm sorry to generalize, it could be anybody, but there's this sort of like, oh, we had a Black president. I just heard that. I just heard Lindsey Graham say that, actually. You know, oh, well, we had a Black president. Everything's good.
So we're not racist.
Uh-huh. We're not a racist country. Uh-huh. But that is not the truth. And what you just said about the website, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think about that.
No.
You wouldn't think about a Black woman being worried about putting her picture on a website. And I'm sure there's numerous other stories that are along those lines.
Oh, there's thousands of them. And you have to be aware of that when you're teaching entrepreneurship as well. That's one of the most unique things about Accelerate. You have to remember sales is taught by white. It's a white male
sure.
ideology and go cold call. And we can never ask a Black woman to go walk into a room full of white men and cold call that scenario. Like, it's so insensitive and it's super tone deaf. And
there's
so
also finances.
Finances.
People say,
oh,
finances are just for men and women can't do banking. And
which is so not true.
You know, that sort of thing. But that's the way it still is in society, is there's this sort of like, men do financial things.
That's right. But we have to break down the normative values that women, you know, we're supposed to be in the kitchen. We're the caretakers, the child and the elder caretakers. I mean, we're in this. So this is not anywhere. We still are not paid an equal wage. And you know, cognitive bias is real. And that's how our brains work. Our brains are built to filter information. But if we don't become aware of how they contribute to racism and sexism, we're going to perpetuate that same thing, no matter what work we do or what book we read or what black square we put up on our Instagram, you know. And that is really what the when we say, you know, stop being performative, when you hear communities of color ask allies to stop being performative, they're really asking us to question down to the core why we do and say and feel and that's language, that's teaching entrepreneurship, that's capitalism. Like, I oftentimes get caught up, Michael, like, why am I teaching people to become business owners and when I oftentimes think capitalism is toxic? You know, obviously you and I, we teach sustainable business operations, and B Corp is interesting to us for that reason, and social enterprise is interesting for that reason, and we can teach women that. But really, like, how do we break down the barriers when this system has done nothing but fork over an entire communities of color?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned, you know, a woman who's white or women who are white with people of color, women of color, women identifying of color in the same room. One thing I've noticed lately is there are a lot of white people, and myself included, you know, I don't know, people are not using the word woke, you know, but I'm a little more educated than most because I actively engage and I, not just with reading, but actually asking people questions. What are you going through? And I really have black friends, you know, people say I have black friends.
That helps.
But what I'm getting at is there's a lot of people, especially white people, who are fearful of doing the wrong thing. And so they pause and they don't do anything. And so it's sort of this walking on eggshells.
Right.
You know, if I get involved, and you know, I know there's training on this, there's bystander intervention training and there's things like that.
Sure.
So, and let me give you an example. Let me give you a story. Okay. So Andy, my boyfriend, who's amazing for numerous reasons, he was at the grocery store and there was a black family there and they were probably like $65, maybe $80 short on groceries. And Andy asked them, can I pay? And he did. And he paid for them and they accepted. And he came home and told me the story and he was like, did I do the wrong thing? And I said, well, what do you mean? You know, why would you say or why would you think you did the wrong thing? I said, the wrong thing would probably be you announcing in Safeway, like, hey, everybody, I just helped this black family.
Right.
You know, like that would be part of it or calling out like as you're in line, like, I can't believe this family. They can't pay. Fine, I'll pay for them. And that's not how he did it. But what he told me is that there was a fear of doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is if there's a lot of people, and not my boyfriend, I mean, we talk about these things.
Sure.
I mean, this is a really great thing about my relationship is we talk about everything. And one of them is social justice issues. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is there are potentially white people who really do want to say the right thing or really do want to help, they may be fearful and they may not know if what they do is not the thing that the person wants.
That's right.
And so I'm trying to conceptualize, and I don't have that power, but these are the things that keep me up at night, how people of different races can come together, understand each other, and I don't know if assuming best intentions is the thing, but knowing that it's better to ask and to potentially get involved.
Absolutely.
Than to not do anything or to walk away from the situation. And it's the same thing with racism. I mean, it's hard to know if someone would want you to be involved, but it's not enough to be anti-racism. You have to be vocal against racism. So my whole, and again, there's me rambling, but my whole thing is how do we teach white people that it's okay to have these reactions and to help, and you have to do something.
You do. And it's messy. You know what? It's going to be fucking messy. Like, excuse my language, but we're all going to have to get real uncomfortable and get real close to being uncertain and unsure. And if we all show each other a little grace, I think, first of all.
There's that Georgia page.
You got to say grace. This is really important. I mean, I think that first and foremost, it's not, there's no perfect, there's no book on it. Don't ask me for the book. I get asked for the book all the time. It doesn't exist. But first of all, then you have to have intent versus impact. Do you have a true intention? Because if you do, it's really going to start with you exploring what's happening inside of you and dealing with your own trauma and your own stuff. And I keep saying that because I don't use the word woke that much, but my own journey has been, the inclusion work has been revealed to me through my own work and my own path to enlightenment. And for me, that's like exploring why the ego sucks and doing that work for myself. It's become real obvious. The cultural competency training and the DEI work and all that stuff becomes real obvious when I deal with my own trauma. And so I think we're going to have to get used to being okay with it being uncomfortable. Mm. And then if you're not sure, ask yourself, well, if it was a white family, would you help them? The mom was futzing around her purse and she couldn't pay or the card was declined. You would likely go and help. What's the right thing to do?
Andy's Andy, so yeah.
He would. Some people don't do that.
I tell him, you know, he's salt of the earth, that sort of thing.
Sweet
His family is the type that really will give you their t-shirt. They'll bake you a pie. You know, they actually care. There's not shame and guilt and subtext and... So,
but that also comes with knowing yourself and being comfortable with yourself and dealing with your own stuff. And again, like, I really believe that we're good humans. I have also embraced a mindset of abundance that has changed for me. Like, I was an asshole in my 20s. I was an asshole because I didn't have my own stuff addressed and I didn't figure it out. And now I see the world in so many different ways. I don't seek happiness. It's inside me. Failure is awesome. I embrace it. Bring it on.
Giving is joyful for me.
Giving is joyful. Like, and sharing being grateful. What I have the privilege for, you know, and I think even, when in the context of giving back is just understanding that, you know, the conversation, for instance, around reparations and all of that, it really does come from a place of equity and us having access and those others not, to make the life that they want for themselves. And I've really walked through this life with freedom to anything I've wanted. Those folks don't have that. They're freedom from everything is about, right, the negative freedom versus the positive freedom. And for that, I've switched my mindset to that of abundance. There's plenty of resources. There's plenty to go around. And I think you have to remember that the reason why racism and sexism is different in this country than all the other countries, because remember, there's other countries out there. We have a very unique, because it's our political system that creates a narrative of division. And I think that we have to figure out a way to push that aside, turn the TV off, go get involved in the community, go do mutual aid work, go get yourself, if you're a woman and you're an entrepreneur, join Accelerate's peer group so you can surround yourself with women of way different backgrounds than you. You do have to be willing to invest in the being uncomfortable with the fact that you might not know anything about a brown or a black woman. And the only way to know is to experience their lives through their eyes, to ask them questions, to be curious, but through an authentic. I mean, they're not here to do your labor for you.
Mm-hmm. Or if someone's offended, it may not be about you that day. Because what happens is it ends up being about the person who's called out or who has to talk about what they said. When we forget about the person who's actually hurt,
that's right.
They're sitting over here.
And a little bit of grace. I mean, I just want to circle right back around to grace, because if us white women especially, I mean, I can only view the world through that lens, but if we can't understand how painful things are for black folk right now in this country, like if we can't walk a day in those shoes, we really need to look at inside of what we've become. Because honestly, if you don't think that any black person right now is walking around feeling the heavy weight of trauma and pain and fear, this country, then I am sorry, but you have completely missed the whole thing. Like, your life is just passing you by. I really believe that. And right now, we can't have any expectations. They're just trying to survive.
So you didn't write the book. But what, I mean, what is Amy, you know, who you said, or, you know, you present as a white woman. What does Amy say to other white women who are like, I care, but I don't know what to do or what to say or how to be involved?
Yeah, it's a great question.
What do you say to that person?
It's hard. We have these conversations at Accelerate because we have the platform. But, you know, we spend a lot of time convening these discussions, particularly entrepreneurs, white women. Well, I put the black thing up on my Instagram. What do I do now? And we put them in a room with other women, black women, brown women, to have those conversations. But one-on-one, you know, I really do start to dig into that person's life. And most women are coming, again, with a lot of baggage. And I'm not afraid to tell people about my own therapeutic journey, suggest some books, talk about complex PTSD. I mean, whatever it is, like, that we have to talk about. My role is really to be a mentor to all the women, particularly white women, because that's where I can come in and make some adjustments. But to show them that we have the power to invest in our communities and be catalysts for change. And that starts with us. It really, white women, there's a lot of white women, and a lot of them have power. And I still believe that women are the centers of our community. And so we actually call on white women to start doing the work and engaging, first for themselves, because they've got their own trauma and white women are dealing with stuff, but they need to deal with it so that then we can collectively get together and support all of our other sisters. And I think that's really, it's not a feminist agenda at all. It's really a participatory approach that says, listen, let's get our house in order over here so that we can then stand up this economy that represents our values. And those are values of sustainability and long-term thinking and generational wealth for the long line of women to come after us, you know, if that makes sense. And so we really do spend a lot of time convening white women just as much and focusing on what we can do with them. And basically, a lot of that is the dialoguing and the collective story sharing, telling the stories and letting them listen. And it's a safe place. It's a real safe place to have that dialogue. So there's much more to this community than we ever imagined. Entrepreneurship is one thing, right? But within that, women show up with them their whole selves in business, and we've figured out a way to kind of leverage that towards social change.
Well, and I like what you said, though, that it's fucking tough. It's not easy. I don't have all the answers. It's not perfect. Because that tells me that there's real change happening in those walls. You know, when people are sort of, like I said earlier, the toxic positivity or the like, oh, here's a little bit about black people you can learn. Here's a little bit about white people. Let's sit in a room. You know, it's very kumbaya. And those are not productive at all, because nobody has to face their past. Nobody has to face their fear. Nobody is growth or reflective,
right?
You know, growing in that way. So it sounds like what you're doing, I mean, you're doing the work, the nitty gritty work. And that's all that this takes or requires, is the actual hard work, the actual real discussions.
That's right.
Not the painting a pretty picture, post a Black Lives Matter thing, but if you're not actually going to hire black people, or you're not actually going to change your messaging or be reflective on your services, and if they're giving access to other people, then really it's not doing anything.
It's absolutely putting a Band-Aid on it's not solving anything. I mean, it's just making you look good. But there are ways you can do that. I mean, if you're a business, make sure you procure from folks of color. I mean, it's just that simple. Like, there's other ways that you can do it, but you have to look inside your own house and make sure. If we don't clean that up first, we're not going to be able to come authentically to the table. Mm-hmm. One thing I learned about myself was that I thought I was a cock up all my life, like, right? And I'm struggled, and I had a messy journey, and I just thought I'd never become anything. But I leveraged that. There's strength in that struggle. And yeah. So, yeah, that mess equals something real good at the end of the tunnel if you're able to get your house in order and put it together and make it make sense. So, yeah, I really think that... It has to be action oriented. Just stop talking and do it. Like, jump in and do it. If you need tools to learn how to, Accelerate's here, whether you're a woman or a man or you're purple or yellow or whatever. We don't care. You know me. I'm like, I'll serve anybody, really. I don't care. Yeah. If you need something, you want to learn how can I do better, come, we'll have a conversation about that. Because in reality, it's just about, like, if you're a business, you need to make sure that the way that you run your business is inclusive. And that's HR, that's your HR practices, that's where you buy things, that's your clientele. Otherwise, you're not in it. You're not in this to be an ally.
And I know I mentioned earlier, and it's absolutely true, and again, I share that belief, that community building and business building, they go hand in hand. They're not dichotomous in any way. And that's the mistake people make, is they build a business without building a community, or they don't realize how the two interact, or that they both have to be built together in a very intentional manner.
I want to say that that's one of the things I love about your business, but I also want to say that that's also a conversation we have a lot of in our community. Women don't know. I've been raised or told that I need to keep that separate, that my business is not me,
correct.
That I am that, and this is not that. And so a lot of conversations we had last year when the BLM movement became a powder keg and it heated up was, I don't know whether to keep my business separate from my personal or mix it all together. And now I have fear because what if my kids are targeted, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I'd love to hear, like, from your perspective, how you decided that Michael and Rational Unicorn are one and the same, and any advice that you could give, because that really is the right, that's the question. When do you know?
There, I think you reach a point, and I, again, this podcast is about me, but I love that you threw that back.
I had to, just because you've lived, you have lived experience. Yeah, in answering
yeah.
That
so,
question.
So for me, part of it is working for really shitty people that didn't have morals or standards that I believed in or aligned in. Part of it is I have been treated like crap by employers. Part of it is all I can be is who I am, and all I can be is authentic. And it's exhausting for me to have two different roles, to have like a company that looks one way and then to live my personal life a different way. And then another thing is that I know that there's a world of businesses who, excuse my language, rape and pillage, don't pay taxes, don't give a shit about people.
Single bottom line.
So I didn't want to do that. And I've always had a public interest past and been sort of part of that world. And I couldn't practice community business law and teach other people or help other people be authentic with their skill base and their history if I myself was not doing that.
Bingo,
right?
Like, that's right.
How would absolutely. That happen?
Absolutely.
And so you're absolutely right. I bring with me as an attorney my failures, my fears, I tell people, like, you're in 8 different directions? Great, I am too. You know, like,
it's messy.
You have
that's right.
3 random jobs, you hate 2 of them, you want to open your own business, you're a single mother.
I get it.
Come and talk to me. Like, let's talk about this. Like
that. So be the change, Michael. Look, we need to have a podcast that's just cliches. That are, well, they say cliches are true, right? They exist because they're true. But that is true, right? You just want to be the authentic person, and you think that if we're all like that, we're all going to win.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm not a good liar. I'm also not good at being someone I'm not. And I think that a lot of the legal world or the corporate business world wants you or me to be that. And so I continually push back at that.
Yeah.
We can still do business law. We can still help people form businesses and do contracts. So that's the thing that people need to ask. And it's not about me or about you. It's why are we doing this thing we're doing? And does it have to be this way?
That's right.
Is there a different way? Is there a way that can bring more access and more representation? Is there a way that can, not empower, like you said, but accelerate people to places where they need to be?
That's
and
right.
So the answer a lot of times is yes. You could look at various industries and you could actually see another way. So why are we not doing that? So when I have my own business, which I do, my only option was to to do that and
absolutely.
To sort of make something new. And it sounds like for you as well, I mean, you realized not just in the programming, but about that it's not just about loans. It's about education. It's about storytelling. It's about helping people rise above. And so, yeah, I think no matter what industry someone is in, there is the ability to do that. A good example, and, you know, you and I talk for hours, is Andy and I, you know, we're not made of wealth, but we have a financial advisor who has helped us figure out, like, which student loans get paid and which,
That's right.
And she's a Taiwanese immigrant. And she works downtown with a bunch of white men, but she's a woman and an immigrant, and she's Taiwanese, and she is amazing, absolutely amazing. And I love that she's a financial advisor, and she's able to bring her stories, her history, her culture, her learning lessons.
That's right.
To what she does, to a white male dominated industry. And to be herself. And so if we just look at society from that perspective that it doesn't matter. You can break that mold or you can open that door. And I really feel like the best service providers or business owners, for that matter, right. restaurants and things like that, are the people who are able to authentically be themselves.
Absolutely.
And to do the things that they care about and to put forward that passion.
I mean, and I think it's more fun to buy from people. Like, I'm just a really conscious buyer. And so I want to see the story. I want to know what's happening behind this. I want to know who you are. I don't connect to, if I'm going to spend what little hard-earned money I have, I want it to go somewhere that has meaning. And I think that's just something we can all get behind. That's Main Street rural America. That's modern liberal Portland, or whatever they call us in the world these days. I know Portland always gets monikers galore at the federal level these days. But, I mean, in reality, we all want that. And we're all small business owners, and we all want to have the liberty to kind of sell for ourselves, or maybe be our own boss for a minute, or have a good idea and want to take it to the world. And there's so much, for me, beauty in that. And if it's just one color or it's whitewashed, that's not interesting to me. My world's full of color. And it's much more interesting.
The business world should represent the actual world as well. Absolutely. And so that's the beauty of, you know, what you're doing and the program that you're doing, is that you're enabling people to learn that they not only have the opportunity to be involved in those things, but that they can succeed and that they can represent where they're from and who they are.
That's right.
They're not forced to, you know, be someone they're not. And you hear this all the time. You know, someone will say, oh, we'll be more like this or do this, or, you know, this is an industry for men, or we only hire women if they do such and such.
Oh, the, you know, lean, like, in mentality? Is that we don't?
Yeah, that's a little bit just... of, a little bit of that. So, right. So, telling people, you know, who you are is enough, and what you're doing is enough, and what you're doing and who you are beautiful, is a really powerful thing. And I think that, you know, I'm grateful for, because it's hard work. I'm grateful for people like you who have
hard work.
Committed their life to doing this very, very hard work that has to be done.
It's important. I don't really know. I mean, so I've had this battle with myself when I came off of the UN work, and I came back to the States from, you know, a tour, 5-year period, doing pretty high level work. I got to work, you know, in the Parliament in the EU. It was really awesome. And I thought, now I've got job security forever. You know, I'm good to go. And I couldn't get work for a year. And I took it real hard. And I just, again, I thought I was never going to be anything, and I was never going to make any money. And really, a lot of therapy made me realize that chasing that money wasn't what I wanted to be anyways. It's not who I wanted to be. I didn't want to be working at some highfalutin economic development firm in D.C. or, you know, the EU or whatever. That, in fact, what brings me joy is working with other people to build their capacity to feel good about what they do on the ground, but also to bring a little joy to their own lives. Like, sometimes just having a savings account and being able to afford to do certain things, or having the freedom to have kids on your own terms, for instance, for women, or for anyone for that matter these days, and really just feeling like we had our own piece of the pie, my own little version of the American dream, you know, having the freedom to decide if I wanted to be an entrepreneur, or I wanted to be a doctor, or I wanted to be a cook, and being able to live and be comfortable and secure is really important to me. Like, again, economic freedom is just extremely important. I think we take it for granted in this country. And after having traveled the world, I can see that it's just a privilege, Michael. And we in this country have so much privilege to be able to afford the ability to do for ourselves. And we've squandered it in many ways. And so my work really does center around bringing some kind of understanding to how we can all support each other, and that kind of freedom to the economic freedom to have what we want. And I guess all that economic work that I did overseas really was instrumental in me realizing how short life is and how privileged it is. And even those folks in dictatorships that I've worked in or oppressed countries in Africa that I've worked in, how good we have it here if we could just get past our own junk. So I spent a lot of time focused on that, but it doesn't mean that I don't like being overseas as well, working with other populations to build their capacity to also have this kind of economic freedom. And so really that for me is that's the goal. And I had to eschew some things, comforts, but it doesn't really matter because all I get to do now is be with humans. And for me, that human connection and being dialed into that world is liberating. I don't have the TV. I don't have to pay attention to the news. I'm just in it. And this is, for me, where the river meets the road, you know, is the human connections that I've always sought since my own trauma as an abandoned child are here in this work. And it's been healing. It's been part of my own enlightenment and my own journey. And so that for me is really what embracing things really looks like, is being good and safe and comfortable and knowing that.
Well, I am really proud to know you, and I'm happy that you're part of our community. I have a couple more questions that are questions we ask everybody. It's five questions. So the first one is, if this wasn't your focus right now, what would be your passion project?
Well, you know, I'll just be honest. The first thing I think of is there's no passion project. I would just literally be beach bumming it. That's my jam. I just like to travel a lot and I like to observe. So if I actually wasn't doing this, I would literally probably be a bum somewhere, just bumming around. I don't need much to survive. I'm an minimalist. So, yeah, that's where you'll find me, is chilling on a beach somewhere.
That sounds amazing. I love the beach as well. What is something in your life, other than your given or chosen family, emphasis on chosen family,
yes,
that you know will always bring you joy?
Someone or something. That will always bring me joy. I mean, you know, I love my partner. I've been with my partner for 10 years. I met him in Belgium. He's a Moroccan. And so my chosen family, one of the things we love doing is just going back home to his motherland and being involved. But I think core is, to me, is just that I guess the place that I've come home to roost in my own soul. And I know it sounds cheesy, but I've become a certain kind of centered that I never believed I could. And so that inside me, and I continue to do the work, but that place inside me where I know is safe and comfortable, and the people that I've convened around that space is the place.
Awesome. Are you binge watching or reading anything right now?
My partner tries to get me to binge watch. We love Shameless.
Although
I think we've gotten through that one already. No, I don't have a ton of time, so I'd like to do more reading. Let me think what else we just binge watched. You know, my partner's way into spy and CIA, so I think we did The Americans and Homeland recently. We kind of spun those out. But I don't want to do that when I get off of work. Like, I just want to have fun, so we generally put the music on.
Nice. Wonderful. Yeah, I mean, music is everything.
Isn't it?
Yeah. When the world gets, I don't know if normal's the right, but when the world gets more normal or post-pandemic, where would you travel to?
Oh, child, I'm going everywhere.
That's how
I'm about to go to Mexico next week. We decided on a low-key beach vacation where there's not a lot of people. We're going to take a boat, go sit on a beach. But no, Japan's on my list, so I'm hoping to do that soon. I've traveled to a lot of countries. There's a few places I'd like to tick off. I haven't been to Slovenia or Slovakia, so those have been of interest. Paraguay and Uruguay are on my list. Child, I am telling you, I will go everywhere. I've literally, the only reason why I got vaccinated was to plug into any travel that I could make reasonably happen safely. But yeah, I have a long list.
What's your favorite place that you've traveled to?
I love Senegal. Senegal was amazing. Laos is amazing. Phnom Penh, Luang Prabang, Laos, beautiful, beautiful country. Yangon's a beautiful country. I could keep going. I've really been to a lot of phenomenal places. I think Senegal was really eye-opening for me. And I go for experiences. You know, you find me there for a month. I don't go on five-day mm-hmm. vacations. I like to get in there and stay with the locals and embed a little bit. But I've been lucky to travel to a lot of countries. And Africa's pretty. Africa's top of my list. There's a whole bunch to that continent, and I have a lot more to see of it.
And if you were to give a TED Talk, what would you talk about?
No, they don't want me for TED Talks, Michael.
Of course they do.
No, this is the top rank right here. I got Michael Jonas podcast. I'm stoked.
That's very
sweet. I've really made it to the top. No, I don't know. I don't know what I can contribute. Not paid. No, I don't know what they would want me to talk about. You know, I think the one thing that I've struggled with is my journey and being able to tell that story. And I've told a little bit of it today. Thank you for allowing me to do that, because I don't talk often about myself, and I certainly don't share my background, because that's not who I center right now. But it's been a real hard journey for me to see the red thread and to see how much I matter to myself and reconciling, you know, the crap that I've been through and just getting right with myself and being able to define myself in terms of what's going to make me happy on this very, very, very short time that we're allowed to be here. I've always wanted to just be okay. Like, I wanted to be comfortable. I want to be happy. And that just money isn't a part of that, I guess, anymore. And so now I'm really trying to figure out, like, what am I meant to do? Who am I meant to be? And how can I create as little damage as possible while I'm here? And so I'm working on compassionate leadership and just trying to show up for folks and be the leader and the mentor that I really wanted in my life. I mean, I just find that that's where I'm landing. And so that journey and figuring out how that all works is kind of where I'm at right now. So I don't know, maybe they would want to hear something like that, but I don't know. I could also tell really awesome Anthony Bourdain style stories about the restaurant business, and I think people like that too. So
yeah, both are very
We have
popular.
A lot of stories behind the scenes that folks don't know about the restaurant business.
I would be interested in both of those, both the Anthony Bourdain type stories and the finding yourself
the
and
path
compassionate
to enlightenment. Yeah.
Leadership. And then finally, give us some shout outs. So who are people or organizations doing great things in the community that you're like, wow, you know, people who are listening, you have to know what they're doing, or you just want to give a shout out?
Yeah, that's a really good one. Oh my gosh, there's so many. You know, I think other organizations that are crushing it right now, it's really hard in this environment with the pandemic. So any nonprofit that has stood up to the task of helping people pivot, particularly entrepreneurs, through the pandemic, and particularly women and people of color, props to you. You know, Mercy Corps Northwest is a partner of ours. I can think of a few others that are really doing the on-the-ground work. And then I think props to, like, the community for coming through. Mutual aid groups have stepped up. You know, there's I can think of Cameron Witten's organization, the Black Resilience Fund, that he stood up. I mean, $1 million in like 3 weeks. And I think the folks that have really spent time trying to invest in what's happening on the ground here, it's not been easy in Portland. You know, I think there's a bunch of politics wrapped up in the riots and the protests and all the things that happen here. You know, the fact that downtown is shut down a bit, and it takes a whole village to get everybody through that. And so anybody that's on the ground right now that's doing the work to save small businesses, I think Bricks Need Mortar deserves a shout out. They're doing some of the work. BBPDX, Better Business Bureau Portland, which is the alternative chamber here in Portland, really working hard to hit up our policymakers to make capital and resources available. And then some of our legislators, you know, Blumenauer was part of the Restaurant Revitalization mm-hmm. Act and tilling the ground on that. Rep Bonamici is a congresswoman working hard on the child care policy side. And Wyden is tilling the ground on some tax benefits for minority-owned businesses. So, I mean, if we continue to to stand up and advocate for ourselves, and Oregon really is a great place to have a voice, then I think any of those organizations that are fielding our voices on our behalf are, should be well recognized at this point.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this was really great.
I admire you so much, and I'm so happy to see you. And for those of you who don't know, we're like got to get a big bear hug, and I think those are the first human contacts that we're all coming into right
now.
We
know each other by phone and Zoom and Google chat, but not hugging. And,
yes.
You know, there's nothing like a hug. So.
No, when this time capsules, people are going to be like, what are they talking about? We literally have not touched humans in a year. Besides our immediate circle. So it's a real privilege to be able to come and have some chats and chill out and talk business and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
I admire you just as much as you admire me. So we're fangirling each other, as they say. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, and you do the same.
Keep doing the great work that you're doing.
Yeah, let's do it together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Ciao.
We want to thank Amy Germain for being on this episode of the podcast. For more information on Accelerate, including program overviews, events, and peer mentorship, visit accelerateFund.com. That's accelerateFund.com. We want to give another shout out to our friends at X-Ray FM. You can see all the great things they're doing for our community by visiting xray.fm. And of course, a very big thank you to you for checking out this episode of the podcast. Be sure not to miss any of our upcoming guests by subscribing to the podcast on your favorite streaming service. You can also visit alloftyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, custom gear, and if you happen to know anybody that you think would be a great fit for the podcast, click our contact page and let us know. All of Your Business was recorded at JJT Studios and edited at Track 11 Music.